Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
And we're really sorry we started a little late tonight, but we have had some technical difficulties.
We got Larry Dorman on the line here. He's our guest with ASME Union. And, hey, Larry,
how are you?
Hi.
Hi. Did you get our crazy message there? And then you got another one from us.
Yeah, my wife tracked down, was hustling to get home, and I'm coming from a meeting, so I'm in transit, no problems.
Ah, okay. Well,
I wouldn't forget you guys.
Have you on? You've been really busy. You've had a lot of meetings and things.
Yeah, we're all over the state fighting the fight, and just came from a meeting of our paraprofessionals in New Haven. We're dealing with some issues, but we also took time out. A lot of the members wanted to reflect. Today's the 44th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination in Memphis, and of course he was killed trying to help. Striking AFSCME sanitation workers when they're right to a union and to a decent way of life. So, this is always a somber day, April 4th.
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember that Dr. King was fighting for the rights of all disenfranchised and poor people in the United States. I think he really came to realize that discrimination wasn't solely an issue of skin color or ethnicity. It was people who are left out cold of all races and religions.
That was his message, that oppression comes in many forms, and that you can't differentiate discrimination based on race from economic oppression. And
yeah.
He was fighting, he was a strong and passionate advocate for unions and for workers' rights. And I think it was he who said that labor and civil rights are really inseparable. And that's a good statement.
And I think that's a piece of his message that is sometimes missed.
Right. Right. I do too. And, I think the wingers and the, it's history. So,
it's like so much that happens when the mainstream media gets a hold of something, they kind of twist it or leave pieces out of it that are not compatible with their perception or image of the United States, or it's not useful for them.
Yeah, it's fascism, I guess, in its own form.
Exactly. And I'm glad that you pointed that out. And I hope that when people remember Martin Luther King, they really emphasize that, because that was, I think, one of the most important things that he said, because it's relevant to all people.
Which is what got him killed, actually.
Yes, probably.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He didn't have to go to Memphis. He didn't have to stay there longer than he anticipated. The workers wanted him and needed him, and he felt he couldn't abandon them. And, we know the history. We know what happened. And, he foretold his own premature death, unfortunately. But he remains a pretty powerful and incredibly galvanizing figure within the labor movement, and certainly for our AFSCME union. And, we represent people who are trying to live in dignity, live a middle class existence, enjoy some small piece of what's supposed to be the American dream.
Yeah.
Well, I was kind of excited to hear that that Walker in Wisconsin is about ready to be recalled. And
that's incredibly uplifting news. You're glad you brought that up. talked about it on the show, but they reached the threshold for ballots. You know, they got upward 500,000 to have a recall election. And, of course, the issue was his absolute full-out frontal assault on collective bargaining rights, taking them away from workers in Wisconsin. So there is a Democratic candidate running, and, you know, this wasn't simply an attack on the sector workers, it's an attack on everyone. And it seems like
absolutely.
The citizens of Wisconsin are rising up.
Is AFSCME working in Wisconsin to keep up the
absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah. We have staff and volunteer people who are coming in from all over the country and working with the members and also trying to get some of the damaging legislation undone. But right now the focus is to get Walker the hell out of the governor's office and get a more rational and sane person in there. So we'll see what happens.
Gosh, I hope that does happen.
Yeah, they still got a majority in the Senate. Is that going to happen? Yeah.
Yeah, because fortunately what happened during the summer, there were six senators had to face
recall.
And we got three endorsed, labor-endorsed candidates out of the six. So, you know, we fell short there, but you know, having someone else in the governor's office is going to be a major
difference.
Accomplishment. So, but, you know, it's going to take a lot of work to get there. So,
yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about this repeal of the health bill that's possible by the Supreme Court. What is AFSCME's thought on this?
We think the Affordable Care Act should stand. It has, you know, keep in mind, we come at it from a slightly different perspective, as you both know. One of the benefits of being a union member is that we negotiate decent, affordable, quality health care for our members.
Right.
But what we see happening is that it is dramatically eroded for people who don't have union membership or whose employers simply, you know, have just diminished, taken away, or in their own right just simply can't afford the staggering cost. So we thought that this measure was always needed. We've always advocated affordable, accessible health care for everyone. And that's what quote-unquote Obamacare has attempted to do and will do. And I hope that it's not repealed. And certainly we're going to be worse off as a nation if it is repealed. I'll admit that it's an admittedly imperfect piece of legislation.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of compromises that weakened some of its core. But in the end, we need to have it to build on. And if it's taken away, which I don't have any faith in the Supreme Court, these are puppets of Bush and the right. Clarence Thomas's wife is a lobbyist for the insurance industry. It's just absolutely outrageous.
Talk about a conflict of interest. Isn't that outrageous?
It makes me sick that this guy is even allowed to cast a vote. I mean, he should have to recuse himself.
Absolutely.
His wife materially benefits from the insurance industry. And that just shows you the mess that this country's in when we think it's fine business as usual for a Supreme Court justice to be married to somebody who derives income from the health insurance industry.
Well, you know,
so
you know,
I don't have positive expectations, and I realize again that the Affordable Care Act is imperfect. It's a lot of flaws. It can go as far as it
got. But you know what's really
important. But
sorry, Larry. But what amazes me is that Kagan recused herself from 25 different cases. All right.
Yep.
All dealing with Obamacare and dealing with everything that she was soliciting for when she was a Solicitor General.
Right.
But yet, you know, a guy like Thomas, okay, can still, you know, with his wife and with all of his connections and Scalia as well, okay,
mm-hmm.
his connections.
They
know,
never recuse
they,
themselves.
They won't recuse themselves.
No, they proudly remain on the bench making all kinds of rulings. And, you know, again, these are the clowns who brought us Citizens United. which said corporations are people. I hate to be pessimistic, but the you know the history of this Roberts Supreme Court isn't a good one.
No,
they've always weighed in against individuals and workers, and weighed in for the powerful and the wealthy. So I you know I'd be surprised, albeit in a pleasant way, if they uphold the Affordable Care Act, but we'll see.
What would your best guess be to what would happen if, say, they don't uphold the Affordable Health Care Act? What, then what's going to happen?
Well, I don't know. Obviously, you know, we're back
to real
zero. It could, in a you know, I this is just me speaking, you know, kind of extemporaneously. I think in some ways it might help Obama and the Democrats because they've essentially repealed the same bill that Mitt Romney or a similar bill that Mitt Romney supported and advocated is now the law of Massachusetts.
Right.
Now, Romney is out there saying the first thing he's going to do is make sure that Obamacare doesn't go through if he's elected.
Yeah, and you know, I've read many different accounts, Leo and Lyle. I mean, there are people who will tell you that actually Romney Care is a better model for health care than Obamacare. So you know, in a weird way, this could be a spur to a real public policy debate and a debate that will expose the Republicans for the frauds that they are on this issue. We'll see.
It's gonna be interesting. Obama seems to think that it's not going to be repealed.
Yeah. Right, and you know, like I say, we can all sit here and hazard a guess. You know, I'm just looking at this horrendous court, which has people like Alito and John Roberts and Scalia and Clarence Thomas thinking, how the heck is it going to survive? You know, those four and one other tilt the wheel in a different direction. But, you know, if they do strike it down, I think that it's going to, be careful of what you wish for. Be careful of getting what you wish for, and that may be what happens for the Republicans.
It's been a frightening ride with those guys.
It's amazing that we have such horrible appointees in that court.
It is. And you know what's interesting? I think Paul Krugman, somebody wrote an interesting piece that, if it's struck down, this ought to spur to action, having a Medicare for all type approach instead.
I would have loved that to begin with.
It should have been Medicare to begin with,
It should have been that. Yeah, I'm glad we're talking about this because that's really what should have happened. Right?
I mean, Medicare works beautifully. Why not go with the system that works?
Right, instead of this other complicated system. So,
Kucinich advocated that early on, when they were debating that issue. And he said, just make it Medicare,
That was always the simplest solution.
He got knocked out.
What did you think of that, where he lost the primary in Ohio?
In Ohio, I was very surprised.
I really don't know what to make of these results anymore. Other than it's perverse good theater, but
I was pretty shocked. I thought he was very popular in his district and very strong. I was very shocked to hear that. That's if the results were correct.
And the guy that won was a pro. What was he? It was an anti-abortion kind of like a what do they call him? The blue dog Democrat. He was kind of like that. He was more of a
conservative.
A conservative Democrat than who won his seat. Is that bizarre or what?
Larry? I don't know. Maybe he has some problem with his phone there. Larry, can you hear us? His connection is gone.
Yeah, you're still connected with us.
You're still connected on the line if you can hear us, Larry, but we cannot hear you talking.
Might have muted yourself there.
Yeah. Can you hear us? I don't know whether you can or not, Larry. That's weird. He must think we can hear him.
wondering if I should try calling him back.
I don't know.
Larry,
we can't hear you. So if you hang up, we'll call you back.
Yeah, he just hung up.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll call him.
Yeah, we'll call you back, Larry. Leo is looking up your number.
I forgot. It's on the air there. Hey.
Not going in. Well, we're trying to get our guest staff. Oh, there he is.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, we got you back there, Larry. We'll get you right on.
Hi, Larry.
Hey, Larry, what happened there?
Still can't hear you.
No, still can't hear you.
Well, let me try him.
989-9127. Okay, let me try this. 989. 989. Don't say it on the air. Well, we're calling our guest. And we'll see if we can get him. We couldn't hear him. You dialing?
Yeah, it's supposed to be dialing. Can't hear the dial phone. All failed. Not answered.
You haven't put in the right number. Yeah, 860. Yep, now call.
Let's try again.
Now we see if we can get through to him.
He's on the road.
He reached the voicemail of Larry Dorman, Council 4, Public Affairs. Please leave your name, number, and a brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thanks.
He's probably out
at the tone. Please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Larry, you can give us a call back if you want.
We'll be
here for the next 10 minutes or so.
No, we'll be here for the next 45 minutes, actually. So we're on for an hour. So if you can give us a call, we'll appreciate it. Oh, wait. Oh, he's got his home number.
He's got his home number.
Yep, just pulled in.
Oh, okay. We got you now.
Oh, what a crazy connection. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. Could you hear us at all? Or
yeah, you couldn't hear me, but I could hear you perfectly.
Okay, well, we could.
So what I wanted to say before we lose the subject, though, was the Kucinich's district had been, he had been redistricted.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that was a gerrymandered district, so it was a little more conservative.
Ah, okay.
So I don't think he expected to, I shouldn't say nobody expects to lose, but, the odds weren't good for him.
Really? So that's too bad. Do you happen to know what he's doing as a result of that, what he's going to do?
No, I hope he stays active in political life, though. I mean, he was a refreshing voice and, a great one against the war.
Yeah, and he's been in office for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of knew the ropes.
You know, that's the other problem with being one of the two parties, he should have just run as an independent.
Yeah. I think so.
They make it very. You can just say that, but sometimes they make it extremely difficult to get on the ballot.
Well, they do, but I mean, with his longevity
you're both right. I mean, here's the problem, and we're partially at fault. I mean, we don't have, what Lila's talking about, which is, a vital, vibrant, relevant third party system to hold the other two accountable.
Yes, and that's exactly what we need. I really do believe.
I mean, obviously, given what I do for a living and who I represent, you know, I would love to have some kind of, you know, labor slash working family party line with people like Kucinich and Janet, you know, to shake things up. Because these were, you know, elected officials like he were the ones who helped turn the tide with this misbegotten venture in the Middle East that Bush got us in that we're still paying a price for.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Do you think AFSCME would encourage a third party?
Say that again.
Do you think AFSCME would actively encourage a third party if it were a
labor
party?
No, you know, I have to be honest. I can't answer that unequivocally because here in Connecticut we do actually support Connecticut working families, which has petitioning candidates who get on the ballot, and many of them are third-party candidates, and many of them are the mainstream party candidates who also garnered the Working Families endorsement. And the Working Families Coalition is broader than simply the union. So we do have a bit of an interesting model working here, and I think it's had some impact in terms of candidates being reminded that they need to be true and genuine and reflective of the values of working people. So I really do believe that's had some a great deal of positive influence. So, you know, we're trying to pilot that and keep it alive here in Connecticut.
And I know they sometimes they'll endorse a Democratic candidate. But
right. And they've endorsed Republicans too, by the way. If they support, like in the case of the Connecticut Working Families, if they support not just kind of hardcore labor issues, but things like paid sick days, which was legislation that was signed into law last year by Governor Malloy. So, you know, they have a host of issues that they're asking candidates to step forward on. So, and so they have actually, believe it or not, they have endorsed Republicans.
Well, that's good. If it's a Republican that meets their criteria, I can understand.
Right, who might be more open-minded to, you know, supporting worker issues. But I think in the long run, we're going to be better off if we can ever figure out a way to have a party that's going to really, you know, legitimately be the spokesperson for, you know, regular middle-class American values.
Well, speaking of middle-class Americans, I was wondering how things are going at the Red Cross.
Interesting. We settled the strike, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a very bumpy readjustment period. And what's interesting now is that while our members are back at work in Connecticut, there's a big strike going on in Ohio. There's one that's going to happen in Lansing, Michigan. And the national chairman of the Red Cross, Gail McGovern, is starting to come under more scrutiny. So I think that even though our members are back at work, many of the issues that we've raised about blood and donor safety are still very much in the public eye. So,
Larry, what did you win any concessions at all?
Unfortunately, we were vindicated in the National Labor Relations Board complaints about their anti-union activity. Members did get raises retroactively. We did take a big hit on health care, unfortunately, but we also protected a lot of benefits that they were trying to take away. And, you know, we kept our union alive, which is always a risk when you choose to go out on strike. So it was not an ideal settlement by any stretch of the imagination, but the members needed to get back to work, wanted to get back to work, and voted to do that. But what's good is that we're part of this national coalition, and so the Red Cross really still got a lot of explaining to do, and we may be doing some activities here in Connecticut soon, so we'll keep you apprised.
Good.
What about Malloy?
Great question.
Yeah. Oh, well, what's with this guy? I mean, he's just...
That's a great question. Our members are asking it every day, and there's no easy answer. You know, there's no easy answer. You know, I think I try to be, look at things always from a broader standpoint, and, you look at this governor, you know, he did not come into office declaring war on his employees the way Scott Walker did, for example, in Wisconsin.
Right.
We still have to be cognizant of that, and, you know, we still need to recognize that. It was, you know, that kind of mindset prevented the kind of legislation we saw, and we were able to, quite frankly, negotiate an agreement that got our state employees 4 years of job protection. You know, this year he did something that it's unprecedented, and it's a shame that it had to be done. But to his credit, he put forward an initiative to stabilize the pension fund so it would not be a burden on taxpayers down the line, and that it wouldn't disappear when workers start retiring and need it. So he made the push, and it was successful to essentially increase the state's actuarially required contribution, annual required contribution, I should say, to the pension fund to get it on solid footing, because Roland and Rell and others have ignored it. And that's a really positive thing, not because it just, you know, makes it, it protects the benefits for retirees. This is for taxpayers, too, which all our members are taxpayers. So, you know, he's done positive things, but then, you know, he goes on the offensive. He goes to war, as it seemed last year, against state employees, wanting $2 billion in concessions. He didn't have to say that all teachers do is show up for work this year when he gave his State of the State, but he did that. And his education reform initiative kind of got swallowed up by the debate about teacher tenure, because he demonized teachers, which he didn't have to do. He demonized state employees with this DSNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that federal benefits were being distributed. And look, I'm upfront about that. We have state employees who knowingly defrauded the system, and we believe they should be punished, and they will be, and they have been. But many of the workers did not knowingly defraud the system, and yet he's, you know, kind of got on that bandwagon. And so, you know, it's this alternating appreciation and aggravation, a yin-yang thing going on that makes it very hard to figure him out.
I feel really very much affronted that he was supported by the unions and then immediately got into office and went to war with the unions.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and yet, you know, again, I step back and as frustrated as I get with that administration, I hear from AFSCME members in other states that they wish that, you know, he were their governor. Because even in New York, where you have a Democratic governor, Andrew Cuomo, what's he doing? He's trying to, and he looks like he's on the brink of dramatically restructuring for the worst the pensions for current and future state employees.
Yep.
So, you know, I do try to look at the big picture and say, look what's happening in other states. And when you look at what's happening in other states, and then you look at Connecticut, our union coalition did a fantastic job in the end of preserving services, preserving jobs and benefits, and that's not happening anywhere else. You know, we're trying to steer the conversation away from scapegoating public employees for a crisis they never created to the direction it needs to be steered to, which is, this, you know, it was Wall Street, the bankers, and the big boys who broke the economy for middle America. And you know, that's what we need to keep focused on. So I don't, you know, I don't have a good answer for you. It's very, you know, as I say, it's, and you can probably tell from my answer and the tone of my voice, he's a puzzling, you know, enigmatic, frustrating guy. And we don't represent teachers, but you yourself, you know, working in an education system, well, you know, when Malloy didn't have to get on the State of the State and say all teachers do is show up.
Yeah, I think that
was gratuitous.
Very unfair, and it makes me wonder where he's coming from.
Yep.
Especially when he wants to support all these magnet schools.
Well, and we're out here in rural Connecticut, and where he wants to send the money is to the charter schools, which would take it away from schools out here.
Yeah, and I'm reading studies that say that the charter schools aren't showing the same results. You know, so there's a, you know, there's a lot of sleight of hand going on here. These charter schools, you know, aren't necessarily designed to be great for the kids. They're simply designed to be union free, and they're designed to shift public funds into, you know, private hands.
That's exactly right. Now, they're all not bad. There's some that are good, but there are a lot that are performing very poorly.
Exactly.
Why not support our public schools?
Well, that's what I believe, and that's what, you know, the two major unions representing teachers and school employees, AFT and Connecticut and CEA, were saying, you know, in their arguments, that if you want to have a discussion about teacher performance, you can do that. The unions will be the first to tell you they're all for a fair evaluation process. That's not what the governor's legislation was about. Nor was the governor's legislation necessarily about making equitable addressing, you know, the economic and the funding inequities that contribute to poor performance. And, you know, there's no legislation that's going to get around that if we're not honest about it.
I know. Let's face it. You know, people in Westport have more money than people in Hartford.
Exactly.
And maybe there has to be a fairer way to fund schools.
Right. And, you know, the answer isn't, you know, charter schools that have sort of ulterior motives with regard to, you know, doing an end run around collective bargaining or siphoning public funds, because studies are showing that they're not yielding the same results. Their test scores are no better and in many cases worse. And so, you know, if we're going to have a discussion, let's have an honest one. And I think that he, with his, you know, kind of anti-teacher invective, he sort of made it a dishonest debate from the start, and that's why the bill that he was advocating was altered rather significantly by the Education Committee. So we'll see what happens over the next, you know, there's only a month or so left in these.
His fear about closing the technical schools was shot down. I don't know where that came from either.
Right, and, you know, talk about an absurd idea. Why would you?
Oh, it's ridiculous in our economy. We need to have those schools. We need. Those are the people that do. Those are the small employers. They form their own businesses. They employ two or three or four people.
That's right.
You know, that's what we need. I mean, that very, very much upset me.
Yeah, to even bring it up when, you know.
Well, you know, it's like, yeah. Yeah, that's where they get all the. That's where the small businesses get their employees.
Right, and where are you gonna? You know, how are we gonna teach? I've met so many kids who are creative and have a real sense of aesthetics that comes from being in technical school.
Yeah.
And taking the courses. I mean, this is not. You know, this isn't necessarily for the throwaway kids. You've got incredibly bright, engaged young people who need this system and who end up with real, good-paying, decent-paying jobs.
They get very, very good jobs from our technical schools, and it's not that easy.
You know, it's the white-collar economy, quite frankly, right? That's, you know, they're failing to create jobs. So
that's right. That's exactly right. It's not the small businesses that a lot of them come out of those technical schools. You know, those are the chefs, those are the plumbers, the electricians,
exactly.
The guy that. Electronic business, you know, healthcare professionals. I mean, there are a lot, and some of those kids do go on to college. They go to engineering schools, nursing schools. Some become doctors even. You know,
I think what frightens me is that Connecticut is such a wealthy state, but it's a state of such great economic inequality, too, that, you know, the rich are getting richer. The gap is growing wider, and the haves in this state simply can't relate to the have-nots, and they can't relate to the need for middle-class structures like, you know, vocational technical schools, like properly funded state university and state technical college systems. You know, this is very much a state, you know, we care about the Wesleyan and Yale, you know, and we care about Fairfield County and the hedge fund managers, but, you know, we don't care about the chefs and the sanitation workers. And, you know, the florists, and, you know, it's a problem.
It is. It's a problem of not valuing people. It really is. It's a problem of not recognizing the different gifts and appreciating the different gifts that people have. I mean, not everyone goes to Wesleyan or Yale, and I'm not sure that makes you a better person if you do.
And I'll tell you the truth. I mean, I personally, I don't think I'd want to be a plumber. I never thought I'd want to be a plumber. But by God, you know, try to live without one, you know, when you, you know.
You're right.
I was sure glad I had one today, I'll tell you.
And I'm thankful, you know, that God bless plumbers.
Exactly.
And electricians. And,
yeah, I like to say, you know, I never needed a hedge fund manager in my life, but I've certainly needed an electrician after Alfred, Storm Alfred.
You bet.
Yeah, Chip, don't you appreciate those guys when,
yep.
when you really need them? It's
yep.
great.
And there's got to be a place for all that in this state. So.
I think so.
And also, you say this, but you got to appreciate the guy, the municipal worker who's out there plowing the roads and the blizzards and
exactly.
That's
half of our membership, and you know those are the people who are out there.
Yeah.
After Alfred cleaning up, and you know, they have a right to make a decent living too.
But those are the guys that are getting shafted, and it's like, you know, they're forgotten, but they're the most important people in the system.
No, I appreciate you saying that.
That stay in your community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. The money our members earn, what little they make, stays in the community and is spent locally. You know, it's all part of the virtuous economy that's sadly disappearing, I think.
Yeah.
That's a sad thing.
We keep fighting to keep it alive.
Yeah.
Yep, and we're going to keep fighting. We'll never stop.
I know you will, and we really appreciate you being on the air.
Thanks. Sorry for the phone problems, but I'm glad we worked it out.
Well, we all have those now and again, right?
Yep. So thanks for having me.
We had an entire internet problem there earlier tonight.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm glad it's solved. It's always good to talk to you guys.
The whole network got shut down for a little while.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your evening, and I'm sure you'd like to get going and get a little rest.
Yeah, and we'll talk soon.
Yes. Great, Larry.
Thanks very much.
Bye,
Leo. Bye, Lila.
Good night, Larry.
That was Larry Dorman from Council 4, New Britain. He's the public affairs coordinator, and he travels all around the state at all different hours talking to union members, supporting them in their efforts.
And his job is a public affairs coordinator, and therefore,
he's everywhere.
Yeah, we've had Larry on our programs for the last, since 2006, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
Five,
yeah, he's great. You know, during the union difficulties between the state and the union members this past year, he was on TV. You maybe even saw him. He was there.
Yeah, he's usually the guy up front there that they talk to.
And when you saw the Red Cross workers striking, he was there too.
Yep.
He was down there supporting them, and he was in New Haven when there was difficulty down there. So he's all over the place.
He's all over the place, all over the map. And we're grateful to have him. And,
yeah, he always gives us good look at to what's going on in Connecticut and in the nation.
So we thank him for being on. We've got a little bit of news for you to cover tonight. Our show's going an extra. It started at 8:30 this evening due to technical problems that happened. How the Illuminati created an undetectable total mind control sleeve.
Okay, let's go to the article.
I thought that was an interesting thing.
Well, that's probably
especially
through MK Ultra.
About the report from Iron Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But this is it's kind of interesting. And just wanted to cover it here.
From Jibberoo. Dean Henderson, excuse me.
And the Intel Hub, which is...
That didn't come to get printed. The Rothschilds-led international banking cartel learned long ago that it was much easier to brainwash people than to face off with them in open combat. Over the past decades, these techniques led by television programming have become quite sophisticated. The U.S. tested numerous top-secret high-tech weapons systems in the Gulf War theater while using some old low-frequency favorites. When Iraqi ground forces surrendered, many of them were in a total state of delirium and lethargy that could have been induced by extremely low-frequency radio waves, which the U.S. used as a weapon as early as the Vietnam conflict. Yale University and CIA psychiatrist Dr. Jose Delgado studied mind control for the company during the 1950s as part of the MKUltra program. Delgado determined physical control of many brain functions is demonstrated fact. It is even possible to create and follow intentions by electronic stimulation of specific cerebral structures. Movements can be induced by radio command, by remote control. According to the military document written by Colonel Paul Valley and Major Michael Aquino, titled From PSYOP to Midwar, The Psychology of Victory, the U.S. Army used an operational weapons system to map the minds of neutral and enemy individuals and then to change them in accordance with U.S. national interests. The technique was used to secure the surrender of 29,276 armed Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers in 1967 and 1968. The U.S. Navy was so heavily involved in psychotronic research. Many U.S. soldiers who served near the DMZ that divided North and South Vietnam claimed to see UFOs on a regular basis. The Pentagon paper revealed that an electronic barrier was placed along the DMZ by the secretive Jason Society. Major Michael Aquino was an Army PSYOP specialist in Vietnam, where his unit specialized in drug inducement, brainwashing. Oh, he sounds like a charmer. Virus injection, brain implants, hypnosis, and the use of electromagnetic field and extremely low-frequency radio waves. After Vietnam, Aquino moved to San Francisco and founded the Temple of Set.
Oh my God.
Set is the ancient Egyptian name for Lucifer. Aquino was now a senior U.S. military intelligence officer. He had been given a top-secret security clearance on June 9, 1981. Less than a month later, an Army intelligence memo revealed that Aquino's Temple of Set was an offshoot of Anton LaVey's Church of Satan, also headquartered in San Francisco. Two other Set members were Willie Browning and Dennis Mann. Both were Army intelligence officers. The Temple of Set was obsessed with military matters and political fascism. It was especially preoccupied with Nazi Order of Trapezoid. Aquino's official job was history professor at Golden Gate College. The temple recruited the same Hell's Angels who Billy Mellon Hitchcock had used to dole out his bad CIA acid. Its members frequented prostitutes where they engaged in all manner of sadomasochistic activities. Director of Army Counterintelligence Donald Press revealed that Dennis Mann was assigned to the 306 PSYOPS Battalion and that Aquino was assigned to a top-secret program known as Presidio, or Presidio. Presidio is also the name of a spooky complex in the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, where Mikhail Gorbachev frequented as the Soviet Union was falling apart. Was Aquino part of an operation to map the mind of the Soviet Union's last leader and induce him into proposing both glasnost and perestroika, the two free market policies that ultimately led to the Soviet Union's demise? Remember the curious mark which suddenly appeared on Gorbachev's forehead?
Yeah, but that was always there.
Was he implanted with some sort of microchip mind control device to make him think in accordance with U.S. national interests? I don't think so. Such a brilliant technology is marketed on a regular basis throughout the world. International Healthline Corporation and others sell microchip implants in the U.S., Russia, and Europe. The Humane Society has adopted a policy of microchipping all stray pets. The state of Hawaii requires that all pets be microchipped. 6,000 people in Sweden have accepted a microchip in their hand, which they use for all purchases. Trials are underway in Japan. In July 2002, National Public Radio reported a similar trial beginning in Seattle. Later in 2002, after a rash of suspicious abductions of young girls, BBC reported that a British company plans to implant children with microchips so their parents can monitor their whereabouts. Dr. Carl Sanders, a highly acclaimed electronics engineer, revealed that a microchip project he launched to help people with severe severed spinal cords was taken over by the Bill Colby Operation Phoenix in a series of meetings organized by Henry Kissinger. Sanders says the optimal spot for a microchip implant is just below the hairline on a person's forehead, since the device can be recharged by changes in body temperatures, which are most pronounced there. Interesting, this is the location of the pineal gland, or the third eye.
In 1986, Immigration Control Act grants the president the power to mandate any kind of ID he deems necessary. Researchers at Southern California have developed a chip which mimics the hippocampus, the part of the brain that deals with memory. And Pentagon officials are interested in using it in experiments to create a super soldier. Another microchip called BrainGate is being implanted in paralyzed people. It allows them to control their environment by simply thinking. A report from Iron Mountain, in 1961, Kennedy administration officials, George Bundy, Robert McNamara, and Dean Rusk, all CFR and Bilderberger members, led a study group that looked into the problem of peace. And the group met at Iron Mountain, a huge underground corporate nuclear shelter near Hudson, New York, where a CFR think tank, the Hudson Institute, is located. The bunker contained redundant offices in case of nuclear attack for ExxonMobil, World Dutch Shell, and J.P. Morgan. A copy of the group's discussion, known as a report from Iron Mountain, was leaked by a participant and published in 1967 by Dow Press. The report authors saw war as necessary and desirable, stating war itself is the basic social system within which other secondary modes of social organization conflict and conspire. War is the principal organizing force, the essential economic stabilizer of modern societies. And the group worried that through ambitious leadership, the ruling administrative class might lose its ability to rationalize a desired war, leading to the actual disestablishment of military institutions. And that's exactly what we're trying to do, but that ain't going to happen. I mean, we were hoping that would happen years ago, back in the 70s.
The report goes on to say the war system cannot responsibly be allowed to disappear until we know exactly what we plan to put in its place. The possibility of war provides a sense of external necessity without which no government can long remain in power. The basic authority of modern state over its people resides in its war powers. War has served as the last great safeguard against the elimination of necessary classes. Historian Howard Zinn described this conundrum when he wrote, "American capitalism needed international rivalry and peer erotic war to create an artificial community of interest between rich and poor, supplanting the genuine community of interest among the poor that showed itself in sporadic movements, like Wall Street,
yeah. The Iron Mountain Gang was not the first to discover the virtues of war. In 1909, the trustees of the Andrew Carnegie Foundation for International Peace met to discuss pre-World War I American life.
Many were members of Skull and Bones.
Many of the participants were members of Skull and Bones, they concluded. And there are no known means more efficient than war, assuming the objective is altering the life of an entire people. How do we involve the United States in a war? Well, the report from Iron Mountain goes on to propose a proper role for those of lower classes. It just jumped me out there by where I was.
For those of lower classes,
yeah.
Crediting military institutions with providing antisocial elements with an acceptable role in the social structure. The younger and more dangerous of these hostile social groupings have been kept under control by a selective service system. A possible surrogate for the control of potential enemies of society is the reintroduction in some form consistent with modern technology and political process of slavery. The development of a sophisticated form of slavery may be an absolute prerequisite for social control
in a world at peace. World of peace.
Well, we have economic slavery. That's what it is.
You know, it's almost done, but it just says, the Iron Mountain goons, though thrilled by the idea of slavery listed in other socioeconomic substitution for war, a comprehensive social welfare program, a giant open-ended space program aimed at unreachable targets, and a permanent arms inspection regime, an omnipresent global police and peacekeeping force, which is the UN.
Yeah.
Okay. Massive global environmental pollution, which would require a large labor pool to clean up, socially oriented blood sports, and a comprehensive eugenics program. Now, these were all the things that they recommended and all the things that we see today.
The Iraqi genocide fulfilled the dreams of the Club of Rome's zero population growth maniacs, which all, while also providing a testing ground for two of the war's substitutes proposed by Iron Mountain fascists, an arms inspection regime and UN peacekeepers. Both concepts gained traction in the international community thanks to the Gulf War.
Well, the international bankers wanted to punish and depopulate the Iraqi people for their stubbornly socialist leanings, which have historically kept the bankers' four horsemen oil tentacles out of the Iraqi oil patch. They wanted to keep Saddam Hussein in power so that his past despotism, his Panama, could be used as a pretext for U.S. military occupation of the Persian Gulf oil patch. And just as Osama bin Laden later proved useful for the Four Horsemen designs in the Caspian Sea region, Saddam was the perfect villain in ensuring continued oligarchy hegemony over the Persian Gulf oil reserves.
And so it came to pass. Yep.
But I've done a program actually, and read the Iron Mountain report on our show, on one of the Thursday shows, and I forget which one, but it's in our archives. So you can take a look at it. I read the entire report on that show. This one was really quite frightening. We haven't heard much about Tokyo, and tonight I wanted to, when I saw this article, I was quite concerned because it's not over. Government plans for the worst, the forced evacuation of Tokyo.
I don't know how they're going to do that.
But it has, for the most part, disappeared from mainstream view, the Fukushima nuclear disaster is anything but over. In fact, the situation in Japan has gone from bad to worse. And bottom line, there is no way to contain the radiation. Even more alarming is that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and other agencies have warned that the nuclear storage pools, the containment units that are being used to cool the nuclear fuel, have been damaged and may collapse under their own weight. And such an event would cause widespread nuclear fallout throughout the region and force the government to evacuate the nearly 10 million residents of Tokyo and the surrounding areas, a scenario which government emergency planners are now taking into serious consideration. I wanted to read that because if you hear about it eventually, you'll know that they've been working on it. You know, one of the biggest issues.
Leading Japanese newspaper Mainichi Daily News reports, one of the biggest issues that we face is the possibility that the spent nuclear fuel pool of the number 4 reactor at the stricken Fukushima number 1 nuclear plant will collapse.
This is something that experts from both within and outside Japan have pointed out since the massive quake struck. TEPCO, which is the company that owns it, meanwhile, says that the situation is under control. However, not only independent experts, but also sources within the government say that it's a grave concern. And the storage pool, the number 4 reactor building, has a total of 1,535 fuel rods, or 460 tons of nuclear fuel in it. The 7-story building itself has suffered great damage, and with the storage pool barely intact on the building's 3rd and 4th floors, the roof has been blown away. If the storage pool breaks and runs dry, the nuclear fuel inside will overheat and explode, causing a massive amount of radioactive substance to spread over a wide area. That's what happened in Chernobyl. Boom. And both the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and French Nuclear Energy Company or even have warned about the risk. So, but this article goes on, but I'm trying to find where it says about evacuating.
Go up. It said in the, it's in dark, but go on. The worst-case scenario drawn up by the government includes not only the collapse of number 4 reactor pool, but the disintegration of spent fuel rods from all plants other reactors. If this were to happen, residents in the Tokyo metropolitan area would be forced to evacuate.
And former Minister of Land, Infrastructure, Transport, and Tourism, Azumi Mabuchi.
Sumio Mabuchi.
Yeah. Who was appointed to the post. Prime Minister Nanto Hikan's advisor, blah, 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 but immediately after its outbreak proposed the injection of concrete from below the number 4 reactor in the bottom of the storage pool, Chernobyl style, and inspections of the pool floor, however, led TEPCO to conclude that the pool was strong enough without additional concrete, and the plans were scrapped, and the anti-seismic reinforcements were made to the reactor building instead.
Mistake.
Yeah, there was a chance early on that the storage pool collapse could be prevented, but according to the report, Tokyo Electric Power Company refused to take the necessary steps as a cost-cutting measure.
Stupid.
Now, as a radiation fallout envelopes the entire northern hemisphere, there is a distinct possibility that crisis will move into an even more critical and dangerous phase. And when news of the disaster first emerged, we warned, contrary to mainstream experts, that it could be much worse than the Chernobyl accident of the 1980s, that no containment could be possible for at least a few years. The radiation levels across North America would skyrocket, which they already have, by the way. California is 500 times more.
I'm glad I don't live in California.
Yeah, 500 times
California.
Stronger than you know.
And Washington or Oregon, any of those places, British Columbia.
A year on, we are seeing adverse impacts on ocean water throughout the Pacific, and ground levels of radioactive contaminants are well beyond safety thresholds for portable water, food, and soil. With the Japanese economy already in the brink of meltdown and the rest of the world drowning in debt, an escalation in the severity of the disaster in Japan could be the last nail in the coffin for world financial markets and economic growth. Even worse, if storage pools in number 4 reactor collapse and disintegrate, as the U.S. Nuclear Regulation Commission has warned could happen, we will see a humanitarian crisis on an unprecedented scale, as millions of refugees will have no choice but to flee Tokyo. They will have no possessions, no money, no food, no water, no shelter, and very fragile safety net.
This is what
the SHTF looks like.
The government lies, the corporate cover-up, downplaying of the severity of the crisis, and then panic.
Yep. And Hat Tip Satoru was the guy who...
Satori.
So that's what's happening there, folks. And it's like...
What a mess.
You know, get ready for some serious news.
Well, we're right to the end of our show.
Yeah. And this would be... 7.1 million Americans are in the prison system, so corporations can profit from your tax money.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's see, is there anything quick that I can... There's another one. World's largest solar plant with second largest ever Department of Energy loan guarantee files for bankruptcy.
It's the
another
third one.
Another
one. Solyndra,
yeah.
Was just the appetizer.
Earlier today, in what will come as a surprise only to members of the administration, the company, which proudly held the rights to the world's largest solar power project, the hilariously named Solar Trust of America, filed for bankruptcy. And while one could say that the company's epic collapse is more of a function of alternative energy politics in Germany, where it is 70% parent,
Solar Millennium AG filed for bankruptcy last December. What is relevant is that last April, STA was the proud recipient of $2.1 billion conditional loan from the Department of Energy. Incidentally, the second largest loan ever handled out by the DOE, Stephen Chu.
So with that in mind, folks.
That's where our money's going to.
This one was really weird.
priest at PC autoplays gay porn slideshow to congregation by accident. He has a gay porn show on his PC. But we just lost our stream here, but we're kind of in.
I'm so sorry to laugh at that. It just seems so ridiculous.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Can you imagine? Oh my God.
Yeah.
But anyway, thanks for listening to the show. Stay tuned tomorrow night.
Yeah.
You can listen to Leo on Thursday night. I won't be on, and I don't know whether you're going to be on Friday.
No, Friday night. I don't think we'll be.
Okay, and then we'll be back on again next Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I'll say to folks, have a happy long weekend. It's Easter weekend. For those of you that celebrate Easter, have a happy Easter.
Yeah.
And good night.
Good night, everybody. Have a great night.